The following program may contain content that your kids would love to hear, but you may not want them to.
Oh my God, that show was awful.
I was having a blast listening to it.
But the crowd wasn't. Did you hear them? They were totally against me.
Hey, man, sometimes that'll happen. Remember, they even turned against Jesus Christ.
I'm starting to think I'm not Jesus Christ, though.
You're not, though. Did you actually think that?
I mean, I had no control over the stage. I thought I just naturally came off dominant.
I can't tell if you're doing a bit right now.
Why would that be a bit? That show is awful.
That would be a bit because it was funny.
How was that funny?
Funny in that you are the anti-poster child to masculinity.
What does that mean?
Right, you're the only man I know with a feminine build.
That's a little rude, isn't it?
But it's funny! You need to be able to laugh at yourself. If you're asking people to laugh at their shortcomings, you gotta be able to laugh at your own.
That'd require me to have shortcomings now, wouldn't it?
You see, you're on your way. Look, this is the last place I could book within a 5-mile radius because your mom won't let us leave the city limits. This is your last chance.
I mean, when you say it like that, it will be my last chance.
Why can't you do this stuff on stage?
Because it's not funny.
But it is.
It's not how funny works.
You don't get to decide how funny works.
But I'm the comedian.
Are you the one laughing?
I mean, sometimes.
Then you gotta ask yourself, who are you performing for?
Yeah, I don't know.
You should probably figure that out.
Yeah, I should, shouldn't I?
You gonna show up tonight?
Tony.
Clifton.
Jeez.
Well, that must be one of Tony's fans.
How do you know him?
Well, I know that Tony Clifton shows up once in a while where you're performing.
Yes, well, he's only on two occasions, really. You know,
when you were on Dinah Shore, did he not walk on and throw eggs at Dinah?
Okay, when I
and you
what
were...
I heard was that Tony Clifton was on the Dinah Shore show. And he threw eggs at Dinah, and he was very rude, and he was late, and he had to be carried out by security guards, and he was mean to the audience. And what happened was, being that there's this rumor going around town that I'm him...
Everybody says you
I
are,
I know,
Tony
and
Clifton.
So they, all of a sudden in all the papers, it said Andy Kaufman went on the Dinah Shore show and threw eggs at her, and was carried off by security guards, but I wasn't there.
Hmm.
Now, the thing is, the reason that this got started was because in 1969... I went to Las Vegas and to see Elvis Presley, and in the lounge the next day I saw Tony Clifton, who I didn't know who he was, but I just thought he was really a funny guy. So a few years later in New York, I started imitating him, and as the years went on, I started putting on makeup and doing him as a character. But it was really an imitation of this guy I had seen. Now, about 2 years ago in the Comedy Store in Los Angeles, I played there for 4 nights, and I would open for myself. I would, like, put on a wig and makeup and come out, and some people didn't know it was really me, but many people did. However, for one night, I thought, for a joke, I'll get the real guy.
Oh, I was there.
You were there?
I saw Tony Clifton open for you.
Uh-huh.
That was just one night he did.
No, no. Well, three of those nights it was me, and one of them it was him. I don't know which one you were there, but anyway.
Well, I saw you.
What happened was everybody... What happened was everybody...
She may buy this, but I don't buy it at all.
No, but what happened was...
Name somebody who's ever seen you together.
Oh, 2,800 people at Carnegie Hall saw us together.
Sure, I did too, because
on the same stage you saw a guy, Tony Clifton.
Tony Clifton.
And you saw Andy Kaufman on the same stage.
Between Tony Clifton and Andy Kaufman, there was a tap dancing school from Santa Monica that was the in-between act.
How did I miss that night?
And then Andy Kaufman came out afterwards.
But you never saw them on the stage together at the same time.
No, well, they don't do that.
No, we do.
Oh, you do? I didn't see.
The only other time I ever worked with them was at the Huntington Hartford in Los Angeles and Carnegie Hall in New York. And it's on tape. It's been shown on the cable TVs at home. The Carnegie Hall concert has at the end, Tony Clifton and I do a duet together. We sing Nothing Could Be Finer Than
Between Carol. That's so simple. I could do a duet with myself right now here. But through the wonderful sophistication of our TAV equipment.
Okay, fine. But 2,800 people who were witnesses there,
live in the place,
saw it. They'll swear to you that that's what they saw. I mean, there was me and Tony Clifton doing a duet together.
But why would he, if you were booked on the Dinah Shore show, why would he go over and throw eggs at Miss Shore?
What, I don't really know.
A lovely lady.
I don't know. All I know, what I think happened was that the Dinah Shore people probably presumed or assumed that it was me when they booked him. because the rumor is that I'm him. So when they said, oh, we would like Tony Clifton, they probably thought that they were getting me in disguise. And what happened was they got the real guy, and he just totally tore the place into shambles. This is true. You can have him on your show, and you'll tell me, see for yourself if you think it's me.
I would love to have him on my show. Can you arrange it?
I can't arrange it, but you can find out who his agent is and just go ahead and arrange
Where's he appearing right now, for example?
I have no idea. I don't hardly know him.
Sure.
All I've done is talk to him a few times, hello, goodbye, when he works with me, and that's it. I hardly know him.
How come you never blink?
I don't know.
Do you believe that whole story? As an actor and one who judges character.
You know, whether Tony's really alive or not?
Yeah.
I don't know Tony.
I'd love to have him on your show.
I'd love to, Andy.
And if I'm in town, I'd be happy to prove it to you by coming here myself. And, you know, I'll be here with
so Tony, and you would be
if you want
in prayer.
Right.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't mind.
You're not going to back out of this thing that you're going to do today. You are actually going to wrestle a woman.
Uh huh.
Why don't you ever wrestle a man?
I'd rather wrestle a woman.
We will be back after this message.
A new generation of chronicling may be among us. At least at this point it is. So it is the beginning of a new era. But not necessarily the new era, per se. I am Ray Catolo. I am, coincidentally, whose name adorns the title of the program. Frank Catolo cannot be here tonight, so instead I have taken his place. I am, however, not going to be him. And for the next 2 hours, whatever comes up on my mind, whatever words exit my mouth, will be what is aired across the world, the continent, the galaxy-sphere, the atmosphere, and every other sort of location that is known to man and some to animals. Well, I guess it's time to roll in. Buckle up. Today's show is, of course, brought to you by The Economic Journal, which I picked up at 2nd and Charles for free. It contains articles including on the determination of the general wage level, a world analysis, trade as a handmaiden of growth, and the magnitude of rate of growth effects on aggregate savings. And of course, with support from viewers like you. However, the tote bags have not come in yet. From IceCap, to Hamlet, to City, to Othello, and into every Midsummer Night's Dream, I am Ray Catolo. At least that's who I claim to be at this point in time in the collage that we were just listening to. And I do mean we, because I am also as much of an active listener as you are out there of whatever kind of manifestation is speaking at the time, whether I really am with me or not. And this entire introduction very much parallels the idea of the collage earlier on, because the first part was of my album that I released back in early August, my stand-up album called So I Decided to Record a Comedy Album, which, by the way, you can buy in stores now. It's free, so I really recommend that you buy it, especially for the price of free. That's the only reason why I even picked up this economic journal, and I also have a journal of comparative economics with me just in case I run out of things to talk about for 2 hours. But I'm good at running off my mouth. I'm good at running in general too, but not long distances over long periods of time, especially now, because I haven't run pretty recently since it just got cold, and I tried to run before I went to Indiana. I ran the day of going to Indiana, so I had an 8-hour car ride from Johnstown, PA to Anderson, Indiana, and that morning, we left at 8 a.m., and I got up at 5:30, I ran with my co-host, because I do another show here on SRN1. I host North American Harness Update, which this entire format now is not necessarily, it's not unnative to make up a word that makes sense in this context to me, because I am one traditionally that also enjoys just to be able to talk as the stream of consciousness flows down the Nile. But I was going to Indiana for that show, and now I'm doing this show because every now and again you'll hear me come on as a co-host with my father, Frank Atola, whose name definitely adorns the title of the show. I mean, mine does too. It's not like my name is different. It just, it means less than his. And this isn't necessarily going to be a permanent thing, but I have agreed, especially because it is Thanksgiving, down here in the States, to take on the show, as well as also the fact that Frank got sick earlier this week and he would much rather be recuperating instead of being down in a basement that is probably 50 degrees Fahrenheit. I almost said Celsius, but that would not necessarily be a bad thing in winter, although it might be a sign of fire. I, however, am dressed up for the occasion. I'm very well dressed for a radio show because I don't really have to wear anything to do radio, actually. It's the Anchorman paradox, where you watch the news and you never know whether or not they're wearing pants. Now, of course, since all of the allegations have been coming out, you better hope they're wearing pants. Charlie Rose, I can tell you, was not wearing pants, but that is that may be too soon, or as Frank says, too early. That may be too early. but I'm already digressing, which goes to show I might actually be a suited host for this program. I can't keep a solid thought going over a course of time. I have to take every other branch and trickle. I don't even know what trickle means in this context. I just didn't have another word that would be synonymous with branch and also related to trees. Not like trees grow trickles, because I'm friends with many ecologists, and never once have they said, oh, the tricklage on this tree is just astounding. No, they're always talking about the branchitude. They call it the branchitude, and I say to them, you're stupid. That's wrong. They're called branches. There's no such thing as branchitude. I'm not even an ecologist, and I know that. And of course, in this day and age, I always know more than you. And that is part of the persona, and that is part of what we're going to be talking about. As I said earlier, August 3rd, I still remember the date I released it. I dropped it midnight August 3rd. It was a Thursday. It was a Thursday morning, because midnight is technically morning. And I dropped my album, which I don't really want to get too into what necessarily it's supposed to be about, because that's not really for me to decide. And that very much is the case of the other person I brought up in the collage, Andy Kaufman, who recently is kind of back in the cultural context because of the new Netflix documentary that came out, where Jim Carrey, for those of you who don't know, portrayed Andy Kaufman in the 1998 movie Man on the Moon, which I also saw today. It was a nice double feature, which is much better than Schindler's List and Schindler's List 2. This time the list is longer. That will eat you up. That will take away any kind of soul you had, because you're just in this giant pit of melancholy. Also, there probably isn't a sequel to Schindler's List, and there doesn't necessarily need to be one. But I watched those two movies back to back because watching Jim Carrey portray Andy Kaufman, of course, personality. I don't want to say a comedian, because he would not like to be called a comedian. I don't like to be called a comedian either. But watching Jim Carrey do that, I was wondering how to form he was as Andy, because there is that split of how much is the actor thinking they know what they're doing and they think what they're doing is right, and how much are they actually holding true to, again, the form. And watching back at Andy Kaufman in just behind the scenes and also on stage, as well as watching him within the movie Man on the Moon, it's pretty true to form. And why I bring up Andy Kaufman relative to me is not to say I am the postmodern Andy Kaufman. I am not that much of a narcissist or an egotist or any other kind of tists or ists or cysts for that matter. However, I may be a cyst on the societal doctrine if you really look at my impact on it. But I bring him up because I was recently, I was recently exposed to him watching the documentary and then of course the biography film. The biography film? I don't think that's the biographical feature. let's make it even more pretentious sounding. The biographical feature of Andy Kaufman, died today of large cell carcinoma. Very fitted for the man who died of large cell carcinoma. That's not that. I don't even know what that's supposed to mean. It just, the two go together. I'm gonna get to my point. My point here is when I made this album and how I act a lot of times, in the world is there was one line in particular on the track that I played. The track I played was called On the Road Again. I think it's the sixth track on the album. And, the one line that really hit me, and all, not only that, that became even more striking once I watched Man on the Moon was when my agent portrayed by my great friend Clyde Tamburo, who did all of the other voice work on my album, he asks me, you gotta ask yourself, who are you performing for? And there's a line in Man on the Moon where George Shapiro says to Andy Kaufman after he comes out on stage when Tony Clifton is performing, he says, who are you performing for? This is, you're doing a joke that's only funny to two people. And seeing that and seeing what it was I was doing, it, either in persona, in art, I don't even want to call it art because I feel like I'm just demeaning the form itself. But in endeavors, I'm going to call them endeavors. Just to avoid sounding pretentious, I'm going to sound even more pretentious. The endeavors that we partake in on the trials and tribulations of this mortal coil. That was an odd spike in sound. I promise not to do that ever again. However, my beverage tonight is not spiked, as it should not be. I'm only 18 years of age, so unless I was in the great country of Canada, I could not be spiked at the moment. My hair, however, is spiked. And that was another thing I was going to say, how fitting I'm really getting into Andy Kaufman recently. Other than the front of my head, which is reminiscent of a wind tunnel. Everything else about my hair is very Kaufman. I got the sideburns coming in. I got the outer flares. I got the back part, whatever they call it, the part of the mullet that isn't necessarily a mullet, but it's the crow's feet that, I don't know hair terms. I'm sorry. I did not expect when I inherited this show to have to know hair terms. I also don't know why I'm sounding offended at people who think I should know this when there's no one saying I should. No one's even asking me to talk about hair terms. The point now that I'm going to get back into is watching Kaufman and watching him do his performances. They were, .. as he figures out what exactly he wants to say about them. I also should remember there was one great line in Man on the Moon too, cause Andy Kaufman was a transcendental, meditationist? He was a transcendentalist, I guess, because he practiced transcendental meditation. And there was one line where he was talking with his monk, and he asks his monk after he gets the role on Taxi playing Latka, he asks the monk, what is the secret to being funny? And in the most monkish way possible, after everyone in the group laughs, he says, silence. And I should probably practice that too, especially on radio, where my voice is all I have. Because as I'm talking, I'm realizing that I'm talking to fill the space, but the space also itself is supposed to complement what it is I'm doing. Now, there's also, to go into that too, after that said, a lot of the scenes, not only in Man on the Moon, but relative to when that was in Kaufman's career, which would have been 76 or 77, a lot of his appearances, his performances too. He was always performing. His performances on talk shows and in any kind of public sphere in general were mostly silent. Either that, or he was so true to form and so committed to what he was doing that it became funny. I remember the one appearance he had on Letterman in 1980 where he walked out on stage and he had mucus coming out of one of his nostrils. And he does not say a single word for the first 5 minutes, but the crowd is going, they're hysterical. They're going ballistic just at the sheer awkwardness and ineptitude that Kaufman is portraying on the Letterman show. And of course, David Letterman, in Letterman fashion, has no idea what to do, about it. And that's just a good example of what I was going to say. Because the point that I was going to get to after silence, which silence, of course, is a great element to radio. I've always said I've always wanted my radio to be quieter, and that's why I don't listen to radio. But as I take a sip also, even though this is a new generation of Chronicles, I will remind everyone out there to replenish your precious bodily fluids. I have my second cup of coffee for tonight because I want to be able to be focused, engaged, like an engine, whatever that means. But this is also like the first kind of traditional podcast that I've done in my career, I'd say. I've listened to a lot. I listen to Pete Holmes and I listen to Harmontown, which are two podcasts. For those of you who are regular listeners to Cotola Chronicles that may not listen to other podcasts, those are two podcasts that I do listen to. Harmontown, of course, Dan Harmon, writer of Community, Rick and Morty. He's done some other stuff too. And then Pete Holmes, who has a show on HBO now called Crashing. And he's also just a stand-up from Chicago, originally from Boston. The point that I'm trying to make that I keep getting separated from by my own tangential thoughts is watching Kaufman perform, it was never about him. It was never about him. It was never about how he felt the crowd would perceive him, to an extent, or about how he was never worried about how he looked in general. His ultimate goal was to convey a reaction. And that is definitely something that I know I learned to do at my age. Performing as well as just in everyday life, because I grew up around monotony and the mundane, and being from where I am, I want to counteract that in any way possible. So I will play with the monotonous, or I will mock the mundane, and there'll be examples coming in a bit, but the best, I guess, example of what I'm talking about is the wrestling Kaufman did with the women. Because it's funny looking back at the career of Andy Kaufman and seeing the routines he did, like Mighty Mouse and the Foreign Man, and then how just it doesn't seem like wrestling would fit Andy Kaufman. It's almost a joke itself that he went off and wrestled women. And I don't know if necessarily I feel like he would have known that, because he was, as we would say today, one of the first meta comics of the time. But when he went out, he wanted to play the villain, and he's played a villain for a long time, going back to Tony Clifton, which was also referenced in the collage, because Andy Kaufman and Tony Clifton were different people, as everyone knows. They weren't the same person. If you were to say that they were the same person, I will personally fight you. But he played Tony Clifton as the villain, and that was at a point where it seemed like Kaufman did not want to be portrayed as the villain. He was kind of the innocent soul of performance, and Tony Clifton was meant to be the antithesis of that. He was the villainous figure. But then Kaufman got into wrestling the women, and it's almost like he wanted to be the villain so to raise up women. And the most interesting thing watching that is how nobody, at least, I say nobody loosely because I am only in the time that is now. I can't totally speak for those that were witnessing this in the past. But they would be watching Andy Kaufman and they think, oh, he's gone off the deep end. He's become this misogynist, chauvinist, just pig. And he used to go on to the Saturday Live nights and he would act like he was singing the mouse song mightily and he would do the voice was it was real charming. It was a charming voice he did. It reminded me of voices that weren't from here. You'd say foreign voices and so on, assuming your grandpa talks like that. Grandpa, it could even be your father. The grandpas at this point probably weren't even caring about Andy Kaufman at that time. But what Kaufman was doing with that was he was going out and he was doing everything intentionally. It was never him out there. And that separation of identity is definitely something too that I worked through. And that's a lot of what is on my album, which I thought was also so original for its composition. But as I've been looking back at stuff that's already been done, I'm just realizing that this is all just Kaufman-esque. And there is, in essence, nothing new under the sun. I think Ernest Hemingway wrote that in the Bible. And so, as I take another sip of coffee, I almost choked on my words, and on my coffee. Mostly my words, and maybe some lung. But watching him go out and wrestle the women and purposefully inciting them, playing with them, and doing it all purposefully, it's an interesting case study into how we perceive other people. And it's definitely, I'll use this as an example. So it was a couple months ago, I did a set at my college. I'm a college student, by the way. That's probably why I'm only doing this show on Thanksgiving, because I don't have anything else to do. I'm doing a set at my college, and I had another friend who wanted to do stand-up. And I said to him, I'm going to be doing a set. You want to do a set, too? And we got 30 minutes, so then we split it up. I did 10, he did 10, we did 10. I do my 10. As a matter of fact, I do 15. I didn't expect my material to fill 10 minutes. I do 15 minutes. And I'm flaking because the crowd is not with me. Not only that, I did this thing where my neck got engulfed by my shoulders because I guess I was so nervous about going up on stage, which is strange, considering just how loose of a personality I am. Just listening to how my words are slurring at this point, I should be a very loose person in real life, but Jenny, but Forrest Gump's not the main character, but I do my 15, and it almost worked that my material totally flaked. I did a routine about vacationing in Chernobyl. I did a routine about how kids don't get killed because people speed. They get killed because they get hit by cars, and nobody was on board with that one at all, even though it's true. Because getting hit by the car is the most important thing to happen if you die from a car. If a car goes by you at 80 miles per hour and it doesn't hit you, you're gonna live. That's just a fact that science has proven. But these kids, these college kids, who clearly know way more about everything, begged it to differ. But this is not the show where I rant off about how my generation stinks. However, I am kind of the representation of that. But I did my 15. My friend did his 10. Technically, it was 8, so it was a loose 10. you gotta love terms. He actually did 8 minutes, so it was a loose 10 if you just round up. And at the end of my routine, I did an impressions bit where I did purposefully bad impressions, and the crowd was, again, not on board with it. And then my friend tried to do actual impressions, and his last impression he did was he did an impression of Kermit the Frog. And of course he goes, "Hey, my name is Kermit. Hey, Kermit. I'm a frog. I hop and I dup and I hip hip hop and a hippity hop hop and hip hip hop." I was trying to remember Rapper's Delight so I could sing it like Kermit the Frog. Hip hop, hip hip hop. You don't stop the record to the bang bang rookie to whoop stop the rookie to the rookie to the rookie to be something like that. That was Jim Henson doing Rapper's Delight, and Jim Henson doesn't voice Kermit the Frog. And although if he was still around, he'd be accused of sexual harassment. But the point I'm trying to make, but that's where Jim Henson's hand was up. Kermit, but oh boy, we don't want to go down that rabbit hole. He does his impression of Kermit the Frog, and then I am standing on the side of the stage, and I shout, "Oh, that's not how you do Kermit the Frog," to call, because that's calling back to my routine where I play the pompous, boisterous, overconfident person. And it works that my material bonds, because I walk onto the stage then and I do my Kermit the Frog, which goes a little bit like this. I go out on the stage and I go, "Hi, I'm Kermit the Frog. Waka waka." And the crowd starts booing. They're booing and they're telling me to get off the stage. Now, we planned this. We planned for me to go up there, and we planned for a routine at the end where we joined together, and the crowd still booed me when we tried to convey to them that what was going on here, up here, was totally contrived. That we planned and orchestrated this to fit thoughts and plans we had beforehand. They were still engaged with the illusion that we were presenting on stage, which showed it to be an effective performance, especially because I ended up being the villain in this case. Now, for context, too, the people that were there were also bigger fans of my friend than they were of me, because I'm not necessarily a hit person on campus. I am a person that is on campus part-time, and then the other part of the time, I'm not on campus. Those are the two things that I could possibly be doing. I can't be anywhere else. I can't be in between campus. Well, I could be, but that's called transit. What I am doing, though, is I'm coughing. And I go out and I of course get booed. I'm trying to remember where I was going with this. Oh yeah. And when I'm getting booed, I'm thinking to myself, is this a pro wrestling moment? Because that's all wrestling is just theater. It's aggressive theater. Although I don't think Shakespeare would have written Romeo and Juliet to fit the roles of Hulk Hogan and Dwayne The Rock Johnson. However, Dwayne The Rock Johnson would have made a great Juliet. If you saw him as the Tooth Fairy, you would think he would make a fantastic Juliet Capulet. Oh, and that, I didn't realize that rhymed too, but Romeo Montague. Oh my god, they both rhyme. They both rhyme. Shakespeare! Let's get Shakespeare on the phone. That dapper devil, he made names that rhymed. I didn't even realize that until now, and I've read Romeo and Juliet countless times. Unfortunately, it's not the greatest Shakespeare play. I hold true that Hamlet is the greatest Shakespeare play. And Hamlet also holds a relevance to this conversation of perceived identity, which I guess is what we'll be talking about. And that also will pertain to this generation as a whole, which I will get to later, at least in my artistic mission, my artistic statement. I also have not checked my phone once during this entire show, and until I checked it now, as the millennial I am. So I'm wanting a round of applause, and I'm hearing a round of applause in my head from people that I'm imagining are listening right now at this time, or lifelike, as my father sometimes refers to it as. So I get booed, right? I get booed, and then at the end we do this routine, because my friend works at UPS, and I forget how we segued into it, but at the end we do this song and dance number, where it's just, we do Rockette Kicks, and we're singing the new jingle for UPS, which I think was our way of making up with each other. And the crowd, not only was booing me, they were also just flat out confused about what was going up on upstage. And then watching Kaufman wrestle the women, where he probably had more of an understanding of what it was he was doing, because I can't claim to be very much in the same mind sphere as Kaufman in my youth, as well as just being able to read and react to a room as quickly and as effectively as Kaufman did. But seeing how he would go up there, and he saw everyone reacting animalistically to his person, and then later in the movie Man on the Moon, there's this fantastic line, where, oh, by the way, since, I was just thinking about this earlier, because I was, as I was watching Man on the Moon, but why is it that Courtney Love plays every famous person's love interest? She was the, I was gonna say the hooker. She wasn't the hooker. I don't wanna get into that. She was the mistress to, oh god, what's it, Woody Harrelson played him. Larry Flint. She was the mistress to Larry Flint. She's the wife, or girlfriend to Andy Kaufman in this movie. And then there's also Kurt Cobain. it just seems like she's getting typecasted for these roles. And I could probably pull up her filmography and she's only played love interests. Again, just a thought. It means nothing in the context of what I'm talking about. It's just a thought I had, and I laughed a bit, because her name is Courtney Love, and she's the love interest, so her name could as well be Courtney Love Interest. The point I'm making is not a good one. Well, not that one wasn't, but the one I'm making tonight, maybe. As I want to make sure I keep replenishing my bodily fluids. But there's a line in Man on the Moon where Courtney, or Andy Kaufman says to Courtney Love, I forget the girl, the character Courtney Love is playing, her name. He says to her, you don't know the real me. And then she says, well, that's because there is no real you. And then Andy Kaufman goes, oh, right, I forgot. Which, first off, is a hilarious line. And second off, it goes to show how ahead of the time Andy Kaufman was in terms of postmodernism, in terms of, I don't want to make this the uplifting Andy Kaufman show either, because his material wasn't necessarily that great, but I don't want to say revolutionary either, because it just sounds so pretentious to put it up on that kind of a pedestal, especially for my first show on Cotola Chronicles. But it very much was, it was ahead of its time in that sense of, it was in a case study of identity and of persona, and whether or not that is necessarily separable from the being, or what, the soul itself. And in terms of Andy Kaufman, people saw Andy Kaufman as that caricature he walked out on stage, and never as the person he was until, and that, God, the second to last scene in Man on the Moon, and the last scene in Man on the Moon, are fantastic, because it resolves this so nicely, because Andy Kaufman, he gets large cell carcinoma, and you can still watch this movie, it'll be just as effective. And he performs at Carnegie Hall. If you were alive at this time, you know this happened. He performs at Carnegie Hall while he has cancer. And he takes everyone out for milk and cookies, and you see just the childlike innocence that ultimately was Andy Kaufman. And you saw that too, and you might not have seen that. I don't know why I'm saying you. I saw it. I saw the childlike innocence in Andy Kaufman, as well as just through his performances in general, because the very first scene in the movie is of Andy Kaufman performing in his room as a little kid, and his dad going, you gotta play sports, son. You can't perform for no one. You gotta perform for living beings. And then he goes on and he performs for his little sister.
a song of the cat goes meow, the dog goes woof, the cow goes moo. I almost failed that, and I almost said the cat goes moo, which would be some, it would be close. It just needs the eow, moo eow. The cat goes meow, and that's how you know your cat's gonna die. But identity, that's what I was getting to, and of the separation between caricature and character. Because this is also something that has been hitting with me, not only as a performer, but also as a creative type, as well as also, believe it or not, a person, because I'm just coming to learn that I am, in fact, a person. I did not realize this until a couple of months ago, when, you know, I started feeling people things. I had not felt people things for this entire part of my life. And you may say that makes me a sociopath. I say that makes me a god. The point I'm making here is that kind of egoism is part of the character that I tend to portray. And if you listen to North American Harness Update, I will sometimes do that. I will sometimes go on and I will try and sound as overconfident, as pompous, and as absurdly exaggerative as I possibly can. And I'm doing it all seriously because that is the person that I am. Now, I could also be saying that just so it's conveyed in a pure sense, because if you realize that it's contrived, then it's not funny and it's not engaging anymore, because you're watching, it's very much like you're just watching a figurine instead of a living being out there. And that's the power of character. And that's also something I've learned from my pal Lejos Egroll. Don't call him Lejos. It's Lejos Egri. As I'm reading The Art of Creative Writing and also The Art of Dramatic Writing. Because what we as people want to see is we want to see characters. We want to see living beings portrayed so we can in some way sympathize with it. You can't sympathize with something one-dimensional, because if you know that it's written and you know that there's no soul or any kind of effort behind it, it's just purely prepared, then you can't connect with it because it's static. And that static we do not relate to. That's where the character comes in. The character adds the dimensions to it. Andy Kaufman had many dimensions to his characters because he was able to play with those crowds like that. But the downside was that he, in turn, became his character, not necessarily for himself, to himself, but to everyone else. And I think that's not a case study, but it's a concept in sociology where it's basically is your identity defined by who it is you are or by who it is that you are perceived as? And that's also just a general conflict that I feel many people of this generation. It matters that I feel. I feel that many people in this generation undergo this kind of identical crises. And it has to be emphasized like that. No, it's more of me snapping my fingers. I'm thinking. Okay, it's enough snapping time. No more snapping time. No more. Snap, snap, snap time, snap. This entire show's gonna be snapping time from here on out. You haven't seemed like a crowd that needs to be read The Great Gatsby, which is also one of the God, that's hilarious that Andy Kaufman did that. When a crowd was being so rude and just asking him to do the one character, they just keep shouting for him to do Lotka and interrupting his act, he goes backstage and grabs a copy of The Great Gatsby and he reads the entirety of The Great Gatsby to the crowd. And concept is hilarious, in execution is boring. But that's the other thing too. And this is an interesting concept as well, how time itself makes jokes of the past. Of course, that's a reiteration of comedy plus tragedy equals time. Well, that's not to say what Kaufman was experiencing in that show is tragedy. No, that's not like 9/11 at all. It's more Which my generation, of course, has a blast with making those kind of... That's not a joke saying they may have a blast making 9/11 jokes. That was just a Freudian slip. I don't enjoy those jokes at all because at this point they're oversaturating the market. If you look at I was trying to think of a joke name, if you look at the Dow Jones of comedy, I'm just gonna, if you look at the Dow jokes, it is currently up 600 points for all of the 9/11 humor that the kids are making nowadays, and of course, is being uplifted by AIDS and cancer and all other kinds of maladies that these kids will never have to bear in their lifetimes. No, because death is not in their minds at all. Which, by the way, if you listen to my album, it will be in your mind. But the point that I was going to make, besides putting down my entire generation, who will be inheriting this earth, and in essence inheriting me as their voice, is that... Imagine, like, Jesus talked down to his disciples. Hey, Jonah, you're really gonna walk into the desert looking like that? You gotta put on something, you gotta dress nice for me, Jonah. I understand you just escaped the whale and the ambergris is covering your slacks and everything, but please make yourself presentable for your Lord and Savior. Like, come on! Jesus becomes John Lovitz. I mean, come on! If you're gonna dress for me, you better dress great! Cause I am John Lovitz Christ, attorney at law! That was John Lovitz portraying Jesus Christ. Thank you. And for my next impression, I'm going to need a volunteer. I'm not going to go into that. I keep digressing from the points that I am trying to make. Because this is how my mind operates. Whether it is the mind of the character I am occupying or the mind of my own being is part of the dichotomy of existence that ultimately people don't necessarily recognize. Because we are trained to... We are trained to obey a lot of animalistic impulses with ourselves. I'm thirsty. I go to grab water because life. Water is life. That's one of the first things you learn in creative writing. If there is no water, there is no life. There is no vegetation. There are no indigenous tribes. There are no tents. Vegetation, tribes, tense. Those three things make a community. I remember that children's song growing up. I also remember it only being the last part of that being a song. But as I also take another sip of coffee, which is ultimately probably what's causing my mind to digress so frequently. What was I saying? I'm going to ask the crowd that is not in front of me what it was I was saying. There is that dichotomy of being, of who it is I am acting as and who it is that I am, especially as performers. As performers, that is multiplied because a performer occupies so many different bodies within the course of their life. And in this context too, I'm not talking in a Harvey Weinstein kind of way. That's not the occupying bodies that, why would you think that? How dare you think that? That is not progressive. That is not helping the cause. And most importantly, you're not funny. And that last one hurts the most. If you could forget, that's fundamentalist talk you're doing. But most importantly, it was not funny. When those words hurt more. If I got news that my dog was put down, because I've gotten that news before. We had to put my dog down 2 years ago. If I got that news, compared to someone saying to me, you're not funny, and if it's someone I care about, if it was my dog saying that, I'd want to put her down. No, you don't say that. That's against the law. It couldn't go like that. However, it hurts as equally. I don't know why it does. I also don't know why we uphold humor to be so high. We uphold it. Where do we uphold it? High. You can't uphold it low because that would be downholding it. Downholding it. That's called holding it down. No one says downholding, but we say uphold. Get Shakespeare on the phone. Shakespeare! Shakespeare did not invent the human language. I don't know why I'm giving him credit for it. The point I'm making here. I think it's the sixth time I've said this tonight. I need to find a new catchphrase. Thank you very much. I don't want that to be my catchphrase. I don't want a catchphrase. Because then that goes back into the identity. Then you become the catchphrase. I mean, I'm okay being the punchline. I'm okay making myself the punchline. Andy Kaufman was very much okay with doing that too. If I can put myself down to enhance a punchline, I will do it. Prime example, I'm in an improv group at my college. And we were playing this game. And the premise of the game is there's a scene going on behind the cast of people. And while the scene is going, there's two actors. The actors at any point during the scene can put their hand on one of the cast members sitting in front of them, their heads. And whatever it is that cast member says, it can be anything they say. They have to justify it into the scene that's going on behind them. And, I was the first one to have a hand placed on my head. And there were two things I thought about saying. I thought about saying something totally absurd, something about, at Bozkov's, our mission statement is as follows. But being the first person, I also knew anything absurd that comes after something somewhat serious will be exponentially funnier. So what do? I go serious, because then that next one is funnier. And by doing that, by that conscious decision, no matter, I'm still placing myself underneath to serve something better. The point I make is people probably didn't think I was funny, but, and that hurts, but, that concept holds true for villain v. hero. The hero is more esteemed by his villain. In other words, he's more admired by his villain. If a hero did not have a villain, that contrast is not there. So how heroic is this person necessarily? There's no opposition that is forcing him to become that hero. He's just an ordinary person. If Bruce Wayne was Batman, but he didn't have the Joker or the Tin Man, whoever the hell it was that he fought, then he's just a guy that puts on a suit. And it's probably kinky then, and it doesn't serve anything real poignant or anything else of that sort. I could have said Bane, and I went with the Tin Man, I'm just realizing. Why has there never been a villain called the Tin Man? Hollywood, I understand that there are many openings right now that Harvey Weinstein is trying to get his hands into, but did not want to go there. But, of course, the openings I know you're referring to are creative positions. I want to let you guys know, I have scripts. I don't know if they're good scripts, but I have them. And I have pitches. And I also have... don't finish that one. I have pinches with my fingers. I pinch people. I pinch people with my finger. And then they go, boop. And they go, please don't do that again. And I say, no. Boop. I do it again. I'm also just realizing that Adam Sandler just kind of probably totally ripped off Andy Kaufman's foreign person when he did... any voice that he's ever done. Oh boy, I'm a boy. This is Adam Sandler. That was my Adam Sandler impression. I don't want to get into actually doing impressions because I believe impressions are the bane of our existence. However, if I can do a Bernie Sanders that is 99% on par with Bernie Sanders, then I will be happy with my life. The point here, that's the seventh point. I'm scoring all of these points that mean nothing. But then again, that's how sports work in general. Those points don't amount to anything. Sure, they'll win you a Super Bowl, but what's so super about that bowl? Who are you to say that bowl is super? I'll tell you a Super Bowl when I wake up at 6:54 in the morning after getting very drunk at my college campus. I stumble out into the kitchen. One pant leg on, one pant leg off, multicolored socks on my hands. I walk over to that refrigerator. I open up the refrigerator, I look in, and I go, I don't want anything here, I close it, and I open it again, I go, wait, milk. I grab the milk, I shove the refrigerator shut, I stumble across the kitchen, I slam the milk on the counter, and then I go, wait, I know what I could do with this milk. And then I pour it on myself, and I go, I know what else I can do with this milk. And I grab a bowl. I set the bowl on the counter. And I walk over towards the pantry. The pantry is right next to the refrigerator. I stumble my way over there. I open the refrigerator again, and I go, this isn't the pantry, and I close it. I go, I shouldn't have drank that much last night. And then I go over to the pantry. I open up the pantry. And there's a boy, he's my friend Tony. He's sleeping in there because he got wasted too. And I guess he spent 7 minutes too long in heaven. I think he died, so he's probably in heaven for infinity. But then I look up and I see the Super O's, and I grab the Super O's and I shove the pantry shut. I'll get Tony later once he starts to stink up the place and I remember he's in there. I stumble over back to the counter where the bowl is and I slam the cereal on the counter. And I open up the cereal. There we go. And I pour it out. That's the sound pouring out cereal makes. And then I grab the milk and I go, I know what else I can do with this. And I pour some more on myself and then I go, I know what else I can do with this. And I stare down at the bowl. I see all of the Super O's lying so superbly in an O-shaped fashion. And I grab the milk. I start pouring the milk into the bowl of Super O's. And I keep pouring. I forget that I need to stop pouring, and it's starting to overflow over the bowl, and it's seeping onto the floor. And I run out of milk eventually and go, oh man, I need more milk. So then I go to the store. Now, to be fair, I'm not drunk at this point. I'm sober, acting like I'm drunk. I was never drunk to begin with. I was just doing this for the fun of it. And I get to the store, I get the milk, I get back to my car, I drive back. I have more milk. At this point, the milk that had already overflowed from the bowl is dried on the floor and on the counter. And I open up the milk, the new milk that I got, and I start pouring some more in. And I pour about half of it out, and I go, alright, that's enough milk. I walk over, I grab my spoon. At this point, there's only one Super O left in that bowl. Every other one has overflowed. It's lying on the floor, soggy, limp, and on the counter. And I grab my spoon, and I dip the spoon in to have the one Super O. I put it in my mouth. And I eat it. And I say to myself, wow, that was one Super Bowl. That's a Super Bowl, not this Broncos v. Colts crap that all the people talk about. That was also an example of getting into character. I was portraying a person who liked to act like they were drunk, they were never actually drunk. But I would honestly probably do something like that in my life. And people would perceive that as me being insane. But I am in on the joke, you see. And that's the problem, is how can I convince other people to be in on the joke with me? But then, that goes for the caricature and not for the character. Because who is the character that is me? That's the caricature that is me. But what is me? What is I? What is I? I is me. I would say we're going to break, but I don't really know. I didn't prepare anything for a break, so I guess we'll keep going into this next hour. I guess our break will be reading from. our break is sponsored by the Journal of Comparative Economics, the Journal of the Association for Comparative Economic Studies. And just for a digression, not a digression, a break, an interruption from our conversation that we've been having, I will read an excerpt from the first article in here, Debt Overhang and Barter in Russia by Sergei Guriev, Igor Marikov, and Mathilde Morel. Ironically, names that you would not read in a Dostoevsky novel. Earlier versions of this paper were circulated as Kepper discussion paper 2652, which we'll get to later in the program, and WDI working paper 339. We will unfortunately not get to that one, but that's a great read. Parts of the working papers were included into Makarov's master's thesis at Nintendo Entertainment System, Makarov 2000, and Guriev's habilitation thesis at Kemi, Guriev 2001. We are grateful to David Brown and Sergei Sukolo for providing us with data. Part of this work was carried out in the New Economics School's Research Center within the GET project. GET what project? I don't get this project. Corporate governance in Russia. We would like to thank the Ford Foundation and both Takis Ace Grants 954152R. Okay, so this one's rated R, so there's probably some nudity involved in that grant. Hopefully it's Hugh Grant. Oh, man. And Moscow Public Science Foundation, or MPSF, as it's also referred to, for financial support. We would also like to thank John Bonin, David Brown, Victor Dementiev, Rick Erickson, Barry Icks, Michael Karen, Patrick Sylvester, Konstantin Sonnen, Andrei Yakovlev, our colleagues at Nintendo Entertainment System, Keffer, Roses, Kemi, and participants of the annual WDI CEPR Conference on Transition Economics, Erudite Seminar, and the Nintendo Entertainment System GET Conference for their helpful comments. We are especially grateful to two anonymous referees. That is the overview of this debt overhang and barter in Russia article. As I swipe through, it doesn't seem like there's anything about the election results that I would necessarily be interested in or want in general. So I'm probably not going to read that article anytime soon. Here's one about the effects of market liberalization on the relative earnings of Chinese women. So I assume that's just, it's a guide to how much you should pay for a Chinese hooker. But that's for another show that I may or may not host. I feel like that would be something that I would talk about. I don't know what it is about my character, but something about Chinese hookers really resonates with me. It's time to sip from the coffee once more. Ah, as this is the second hour of the program now. The second hour, of course, always comes after the first. The first hour precedes the second. But what about the third? There is no third, you moron. Why would there be a third hour? Who would want a third hour? I also feel like that's a great title for... If I were to write a movie... That's it. If I were just to write a movie. If I were to write a movie about what happens in the afterlife, I would call it The Third Hour. And I'm going to write that down later. If any of you steal that idea, I will find you. And I will kill you. That was my Liam Neeson impression, by the way. That's probably the best impression I do. So when we last left off in the first hour, before we digressed with the debt resonance of Russia and bartering of some kind, I was using Andy Kaufman as an example of identity between performer and between person. Because he very much was a person that occupied his performance persona, and that is how people perceived him to be. No one knows necessarily who the true Andy Kaufman was. Very much so that a lot of people, especially in my personal life, don't seem to know who it is that I am. And this was, I guess this is my introspection through a retrospection of Andy Kaufman. Because with my stand-up album, which you can buy now for free, it's also on YouTube, it's called So I Decided to Record a Comedy Album. With that album, it very much was me trying to say what it is I wanted to say. You know that this song really resonates with me because the notes are played and they sound a way that really makes me hear it. How generic could I sound with that? With my album, I viewed it as basically my foray into the field where it's an introduction to me. And I took on that conflict that Kaufman just played with. And I kind of brought it behind the scenes with my album. Very much the difference between who I am as a person, who I am as a performer, and how those two commingle, if they ever can. And I don't necessarily, there's no real answer. There shouldn't be an answer for that. That's something I've noticed with, I don't know if it's just my generation or also just human ingenuity as a whole, at least in the postmodern age, we always want the answer. And I think it's transcendental thought, or at the very least, it sounds Eastern in its concept, or very Taoist in its concept. We can't appreciate the answer being that we don't know. We can't find a comfort within the gray on the spectrum, and instead we want either the solid of the white or the solid of the black. We never want to see the two in marriage with each other because it doesn't provide us necessarily what it is that is white or black. We have no concept of gray. However, we identify gray as a color, ironically. And if you look at the color spectrum as a whole, it is a variety of different hues blended together. I'm also a graphic designer, so I understand this. And I also understand color spectrum, as well as most spectrums, because many people say I am on the spectrum. And I find that as an insult to autistic people, because they are some of the greatest people I've ever met. And to clump me with them is just an insult to them. However, and this also is, this is going to segue into another part that I wanted to talk about. I was hanging out with my one friend that was back from college. He goes to college up at Penn State. And I was over at his house yesterday, and his mother, for some reason, was calling all of us savants. And I didn't really feel that how I was acting really necessarily qualified me to be a savant. My pretentiousness might count me to be a savant, but when I hear savant, I always think Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man, because that to me is a term referring to that spectrum. But the other thing with this, and this is also the idea of sincere comedy. Also very Seinfeldian too in how I describe it. I walk into the house. It's a ranch style house in this little neighborhood outside in a suburb outside of this little town. And I walk into the ranch house. I walk into his kitchen through the back door up to the kitchen after walking through. I guess it's called the garden room. What do you call that room that has all the windows, and then you can usually look out to the backyard, and the sunroom that they call it, it's called the sunroom. After walking through the sunroom, there's a little hallway, you go to the left, and then there's the kitchen. And I'm walking through the kitchen, and I look over my right, and I see this bowl of oranges. Not one, not two, not four, but 10 oranges. I understand you can buy oranges in bulk, but in my mind, that was an absurd amount of oranges not to have, because I like oranges as much as the next guy. I will eat an orange a day, for all that matters. It's like my doctor says, an orange a day keeps the apple away. And I would eat, I love oranges. I have nothing against oranges, but to have 10 oranges on exhibit like that just felt like too many oranges, and I could not get over that. I would look down, and there were the oranges. The oranges were always there, and it didn't bother me. I just felt it was absurd, because it's an absurd amount of oranges. And you hear in my voice, I'm sincerely, again, not bothered, but I'm flustered by just the amount of oranges that were there. And I kept bringing it up. And maybe this is why she called me a savant. But I keep bringing up the oranges. And besides the oranges, they had this cat. They have a cat. Her name is Lovey. It would have been much better if I thought that she was a cat that had no name, because they just said, call her whatever you want. And to me, that seems like a much better approach to a pet, especially a cat, because cats don't respond to names. That's a dog thing. You can never call over your cat, here, Snippers. Here, boy. The cat doesn't, I don't think cats understand language. Dogs for some reason do. Cause when Lassie heard the name, she jumped into the well. But, the point here is that, I'm gonna sip from coffee. They have this cat. Besides the absurd amount of oranges, they have this cat. And I walk in, the cat walks out of this hallway that is, right across from the kitchen. And I don't notice the cat at first. How I notice the cat is I just hear a, in that order. It was the same sound, but in that order. And I look down, and this is this fat cat just walking up to me. And it's making that obnoxious noise. And I'm just thinking to myself, I've walked into a Ray Bradbury novel. Like if Larry David took Something Wicked This Way Comes and rewrote it to fit Larry David, this was where I was living right now. Was this pile of oranges, this cat that spoke incredibly loudly, and this family of neo-Christian, not neo-Christian like evangelical, but new age Christians, making autism jokes. Everything about it was just absurd, but it was sincere. It was soulful because it was sincere. And that's, that absurdity, that not only made it more absurd, but that made it more hilarious. Cause I look back on it now, and the amount of oranges there were unnecessary, and I'm still laughing at the fact that there were that many oranges sitting there. It's a dumb detail. Most people would not find it funny. They would just go, that's a pile of oranges. What do you want from you? You want to eat an orange? You want an orange? They can't, people don't have a concept of reading absurdity, because we see the world so seriously, but we also don't understand that seriousness can also be humorous. And Kaufman played with that a lot. He would constantly say, I'm not a comedian. I don't tell jokes. I don't know how to tell a joke. And that makes the crowd laugh even more, because they're going, we're on to you. We see what you're doing here. And when it works like that, it works wonders. But when people can't tell the facetiousness of your seriousness, then it becomes a really blurred line. That happened with me doing stand-up. And that happens with me time and time again, too. Especially in my personal life, because there was, going back, at the beginning of the show, I talked about how I went to Indiana for the show I do every week, North American Harness Update, Fridays at 9 on SRN 1. And there was one point we had this Australian commentator at our booth. And he works with a network called Sky Racing. They broadcast Australian racing as well as American racing. He's a harness commentator for Sky Racing. And he was up from Australia in Indiana, as most Australians would go. They would go to Indiana of any part of the United States. And, I've never met him. I've never met this guy. So when I walk back to the booth, cause I was doing an interview with another, show that was covering the races there. I walk back to my booth, and I see him there, and I pick up on the fact that he's Australian. I think to myself, okay, I've never talked to him before. Let's have some fun here. And I look over at him, and I go, hi, it's nice to see another Australian here in the States. I start trying to convince him that I'm Australian, and I do it first, until my co-hosts go, stop fooling around, you're not Australian. And that irritated the hell out of me, because I wanted to see how far I could take it. And that's always how it is with me. That's the part of Kaufman I see in me, is that I will go as far as I can take it. I never know where to stop. I never did know where to stop. Because for me, I don't understand. I notice this too with myself, is that I have no comprehension of endings. Like, I'm watching a movie and something particularly poignant, I'll go, okay, this is the end. But however, and this could also just be like a Freudian subconscious thing where it's, I never want things to end, so therefore I will continue what it is, whatever it is I'm doing. That's probably like the worst psychiatric diagnosis I could possibly give myself, psychoanalyzing myself on the air. But it makes sense. I go through with things as far as I can take them. I will only let any outside force stop me from what it is I'm doing. Otherwise, I will keep going. There are some times that I can read, okay, this is where I should end because I have nothing else to contribute to this idea that I'm doing right now. But if I were to convince him I was Australian, for instance, for the entire time he was there, I would keep talking like I'm an Australian. Now that could defy the rule of threes that we traditionally hold, not only in comedy, but also in a lot of other fields as a whole. Just the idea of three appeals to the mind very well. And I would have probably annoyed my co-hosts. I annoy them a lot with because I do this Kaufman-like stuff and I don't tell them about it. Because I don't want to tell them, because then they go, okay, I got a plan to do this, and it's not sincere. Because that sincerity, especially in the postmodern world, is what matters. You could get away with it in the modern age and pre-modernism because this idea of public identity and persona outside of politics was not necessarily one that was either examined, investigated, parodied, or anything of the sort. But now, because the market's been so saturated with these performers and with these pieces of art, we continually have to investigate what it is that creates not only the persona, but the person. Because the two, at a certain point, either intermix, they're separated, or they die. They just don't exist at all. But I bring that up because, why did I bring up the Australian? I brought up the Australian related to Kaufman because Kaufman reminded me of something he did. Well, I guess I'm thinking of the wrestling, because he kept doing the wrestling until he hurt his neck, quote unquote. And that's when he realized, okay, that's where I have to stop, because this is not me saying I have to stop. I would keep going. And there was a point too where everyone's going, please, just stop doing the wrestling. Even me, I'm going, stop doing the wrestling, Andy. How much longer can you take this? And he kept doing it, because he kept inciting reactions out of people. He kept inciting people in general. And I do that all the time in my life. And part of me wonders how much those shenanigans are intertwined with myself and how much they are with the persona I'm taking on. And this dichotomy, going back to what I was going to talk about, the idea of being in on the joke, I think, is what I was going to get to. Yeah, because I'm in on the joke. And I have to convey to people what it is that joke is, because it's rooted in the idea of the great cosmic joke, which is that the greatest joke of all is your existence. It's the fact that you're here. There, if you cannot laugh at the fact that you are here, then are you necessarily at atonement with yourself? Again, I think that might be transcendental. It might be Taoist. It's something Eastern. I am Eastern at this point. I love Eastern things. So much so, I live in the Eastern United States. But, not by choice. But, I was gonna make a point. I'm digressing. I'm losing thought. Caffeine! Get in me. I guess now's a good time to segue into my generation. Because I find myself time and time again with kids my age, trying to tell them about how complex the identity is, especially in the modern world. the postmodern world. It's not the, well, the neo-postmodern world, if I'm going to be inheriting this show. And how a person can occupy many different personas. They're also known as a multifaceted person. There's this, and it's natural because I know a lot of kids my age, are thrown into college and they go, okay, what the hell is it that I want to do? Which you think is something you want to figure out before you go to college, because you're spending upmost of like $40,000 to figure out what it is you want to do. That's kind of like if I paid to go on a cruise. I paid $100,000 to go on a cruise. I don't know where the ship's taking me. I don't know where I want it to take me. But I'm just going to go around the ocean. Do nothing. I'm just going to go around the ocean. Paid $100,000 to do this. And I eventually get to my destination. I go, wait, this isn't where I wanted to go. Crap, I need another $100,000 so I can do this again. Because life, in essence, is a cycle of those voyages. Of going out to sea, being lost at sea, and eventually finding the shore. And time and time again, I find myself telling kids, I say kids because I'm clearly a man, I find myself telling kids to ride the wave. Because a lot of times, and I'll use an example that I had. A friend of mine said to me, I want to be the cool guy that I felt I was years ago. How do I do that? And I said to him, I looked him down in the eyes, I said, you can't. And of course I have to explain, because he wanted to be something he was in the past, but you can never be what it is you want to be in the past, because you live in the future of that, you live in the present. You can't exist in the past, because Darwinian principles say you will be eaten. Alive or dead. You'll be dead and then eaten. You're eaten eventually. You might even be eaten alive. I, of course, get eaten alive every time I go on stage, but another sip of coffee. But I tell him that, those are things that you will feel, and you have to ride the wave. Riding the wave is letting life carry you back to the shoreline. Not necessarily saying you're removing any kind of actions you can take to get back to that shoreline, because there's certain things you do on when you're riding the surfboard. You know, you have to kind of like tuck your pelvis in, move your arms out. You're actively participating in the world carrying you back to where it is you want to be. And eventually, assuming you ride the wave well enough and you don't fight the natural order, you go back. You get back to the shore. Now, I also don't want to say natural order, because I also am a person that very much is against, well, no, I'm against the societal order, not the natural order. I don't try and fight the world. I fight the civilization. There's a difference. And I also say to him, because he's a person that is religious, for lack of a better term. He's religious. And whenever I meet a young religious person, I always want to ask them, how much do you necessarily feel that this is you? And a lot of times they don't know how to answer that, which I wouldn't expect them to. But there's also this common pattern in human history of, not necessarily history repeating itself, but every generation passed will pass on its burdens to the next. Which is also why climate change is a thing. But I'm also speaking along the lines of conflicts, either political, personal, intramural. You know, you fight the coach of the winter wrestling team. and then you're not on the wrestling team anymore. Why would wrestling be an intramural? It's not bowling. That'll be my new book, Wrestling is Not Bowling by Ray Catullo. That might just be the title of the book I'm working on right now. But I'm usually not one to pause and go with us, but tonight I am. I'm going to stop doing that from here on out. And so, the reason why I bring up that passing of burdens is religion's a great example of that. You have an institution that is built upon community. Community, of course, is defined by peers, family, relatives, those three. And you can, in some communities, have sex with all of those three. But that's depending on the community, of course. I'm not going to say which ones, but I was not even going to do the Kevin Nealon thing where I would say under my breath what it is that I meant to say, Mr. Subliminal. I was not going to do Mr. Subliminal because I'm not Kevin Nealon. You'll have to stay after this show for the Kevin Nealon show. This is not the Kevin Nealon show. This is Catullo Chronicles. And right now, oh wow, I said that like in the, oh god, there's this old promo that we have on the archive. We sometimes play it every now and again where I go, Catullo Chronicles. And I said Catullo Chronicles in a voice that sounded very similar to that. And not only that, it's strange saying words that carry a meaning that goes back. Like when I say Catullo Chronicles, there's a lot of feelings that go through me every time. First off, it's having to explain to people what the hell it is. Cause growing up, there were a lot of times I would say, yeah, I'm gonna, my dad does a radio show. It's called Catullo Chronicles. And then everyone goes, oh yeah, okay. Yeah. Your dad, he does Catullo Chronicles. It's like, yeah, he does Catullo Chronicles. And then there's also the times of me being on the show. Every time I'm on the show, it's almost like I feel that saying Catullo Chronicles. And especially tonight, when I am talking, I am chronicling as a Catullo. Next week I'll be a Fredowitz, but I hope also this talk of identity makes for a great Thanksgiving. It's much better, than, if I were to get drunk, act like your uncle, and talk about how, Black Lives Matter does not actually matter. But I also, that's another thing I do, first off, if you have an uncle like that, I sympathize with you greatly. Not because I have an uncle like that, but because you can't convince the ignorant. You can't say to Judas, look, don't kill Jesus. He's got a lot of good to offer. And Judas is gonna go, no. No, he doesn't. Cause I'm Judas. And I have to kill him. And then they go, alright, Judas. Fine. You want to be so Judas about it? And then he goes, what do you mean by Judas? And I'm saying, because you're Judas. He goes, I know I'm Judas, but I don't know what you mean in that context. And you go, wait a couple of years and you'll figure it out. And that's when the Bible came out. You know, I find myself shouting about Judas a lot in my life. And I also have times where I say lines that are so absurd that I can't help but laugh. That was one of them. Because I am in on the joke. But back to what I was talking about. Religion. That's what I was talking about. We pass down religion as an institution. And a lot of times we ingrain it into kids to provide them what we think is a foundation of identity. Where it's okay. You take them to church so they learn not to steal, not to kill, not to rape, especially not to rape. That's probably the worst of all of them. I'd rather you kill someone than rape someone. And then, also don't rape thy neighbor. Don't rape thy father. There's a lot of commandments about rape. I don't remember this. Moses, did you do something bad, Moses? Moses is now trending on Twitter for sexual harassment. But when you take, people across the Red Sea and you split the Red Sea, weird things can happen. But, stop saying but. Find a different segue. There's another phrase, I do, where I purposely, I insert it at the end of something stupid it is I say. So that people won't, it will catch people off guard, because I'll say something so inadvertently stupid or just mind-boggling, and I'll act like I'm just gonna move on. Cause I love segues like that. I find them hilarious. I think that's where "and the point is" comes from. And the point I'm trying to make is, I think that's why I say that. It's a crutch. I am very much linguistically crippled. That's why I have a crutch. And that happens to be my crutch at this moment. Hopefully it will heal as time passes. I mean, probably not. But if it did, it might. But going back to what I was talking about for the 15th time tonight. Excuse me. We pass down religion as that foundation of humanity. Basically just teaching kids the tenets of being a decent person. But then from there, as they grow up, we don't necessarily expose to them that there is a wider spectrum to identity than is offered in a lot of religion. Religion, at a certain point, serves as a coping mechanism, as medicine of some kind. It provides you the comfort of someone's watching over me. My actions will pay off for something in the long run. And it's serving me good to be a good person, not only for myself, but also in the eyes of a greater power. Which also is very Freudian in the sense of, we just want to please daddy. But, stop saying but. That's weird to think about too. Wow, that's strange. God is daddy. Oh. That word as a college kid too has many other connotations as well. Daddy. Daddy. Oh, and Louis C.K. Oh, Louis. You made the word daddy weird. Not like the word daddy was strange to begin with, but Louis, you really did it this time, Louis. Ah. We know what the C.K. is short for. We saw it, and as for the first time in the show, I adjust my position. Religion. It is a construct. No, it's not a construct. I keep losing track of what it is I'm saying, especially the second half of the show. Because, oh yes, going back to the original point I brought up, where it's I asked my friend who wanted to be the cool guy he was in the past. I asked him, how much of your faith is necessarily you? Of course there's no answer to that. There shouldn't be an answer. You shouldn't be, unless you're me, because for some reason don't do that again. For some reason I pick up on that very quickly in how I talk. For instance, that God is daddy thing, that's a revelation that I'm probably going to write down later because I want to investigate that. That's an interesting philosophical concept to me. But other people, who I'm just guessing are not as intellectually inclined as I am, as the narcissist of this panel, we asked our panel, and so, I ask kids those questions, because we don't teach this generation, and I'm not sure it's necessarily something we've taught in generations. Especially past, going back to Andy Kaufman, that who you are perceived as and who you are can in fact be two different things. You are able to occupy a variety of identities that may in turn culminate into the identity that is your soul. But a lot of us don't want or don't try to recognize or are unable to recognize that complexity of the soul. And so I have these pamphlets. I don't have these pamphlets. I'm not starting my cult yet. That's not until my book comes out. If it ever comes out. I'm only on page 14. Why am I advertising my book already? But I bring up Andy Kaufman. I bring up identity. I bring up myself. I mostly bring up myself because I am an egotist. But it's also because... Why is it because? It's because, as he thinks to himself, how all of this is cohesive together. What it is that... I am an active learner. I believe that many people should be active learners. I believe that to be an inactive learner is to be dead, because you're inactive. The one thing that separates the living from the dead is motion, because motion is life. Any kind of movement is a sign of life. You look at a heap of rubble, and you see something, you see a floorboard jiggle, or you hear, sounds another thing too, you hear the rubble crumble. The rubble crumble. It's the rubble crumble. Sounds like a Grateful Dead song now. That could be a sign of life. And it's oddly traditional in the modern cultural context to aim for that static, that staticness, that idea of Freud's, which is we all secretly wish that we were dead. Is that Schadenfreude? Or no, I think Schadenfreude is the phenomenon of laughing at other people's pain. I forget what the term is for wanting to die. But there's a certain point where, you know, you get to age 40, you have your wife, you have your kids, you have your dead-end job, and you're living in the suburbs, and that's it. A lot of people just stop there. They might contribute in their community a bit, but otherwise, they basically fulfilled their mission as a person. A lot of times they don't necessarily change, they don't necessarily evolve, and they don't necessarily do a third thing that makes this sound like a decent point. But that phenomenon is one that has, I use the term plagued, that has plagued generations past and present, because it does not promote that growth of the human spirit, which is odd because that growth of the human spirit is very much that childlike innocence that we're brought up into this world in, and over time is withered away by life itself. It's weathered away more like by life itself. If you view childhood innocence as this block of stone, and over time, as the storms go by and the winters pass, there's only going to be so much stone left until eventually it becomes part of the earth itself, as we will at a certain point. And seeing people like Kaufman, seeing what it is I'm capable of doing, seeing how I can be Andy Kaufman. I don't want to be Andy Kaufman. I unintentionally, after recording that album, realized that I was doing Andy Kaufman. But I wasn't necessarily, it was more the idea of what I was doing was Andy Kaufman. It very much was me doing it, because it came from whatever part of inside of me was the most sincere. And in its execution, I also felt it was that way. But then again, I also got similar things to Andy Kaufman, except without the success. I did not get the success of Andy Kaufman, but I'm also only 18. So if I go the Kaufman route, I have about 20 years left. And I got I got the similar reactions. And again, it's that principle of nothing new lies under the sun, which is strange for a culture that's constantly evolving. No matter how estranged we become from our roots, there's still what holds us to the ground. And because we can never lift up from the ground, we're always in contact with those roots. Not like the TV series, or was it the TV movie? I forget which one's the original Roots at this point. Because I know they just, I think it was Forrest Whitaker redid Roots. It was someone redid Roots. It was on the History Channel. I didn't watch it. But I forget what it was I was saying. Whenever I'm at my most profound is when I forget. Which we principally hold as a sign that what you were saying probably wasn't important. In which case, it's a miracle I remembered what I was talking about for the last 100 minutes. Actually, to be honest, more like 90 minutes because the collage was about 10. But as we approach the final 20 on this 2-hour Thanksgiving show, this show of introspection and of retrospection, ultimately going back to the message of Ray Catullo is the new Andy Kaufman, I'm going, no, don't compare me to that. Don't do that. That's the last thing I want you to do. Because very much I, whenever someone comes to me and they say, you remind me of this person I know, I always say to them, great, because I know that person too, and he's a real jerk, or something along those lines. It's a joke that works fairly decently. It's usually worded differently every now and again, but the, that was a strange noise. The idea is always there that I dislike vehemently. I vehemently dislike being compared to people. Even if someone said to me, you are the new Shakespeare, I would go, who are you to judge? Shakespeare already came and went. I'm not Shakespeare, but I am Shakespeare in the flesh. And that's the paradox of it. Don't compare me to Shakespeare, but compare me to Shakespeare. That's also, of course, the conundrum of the ego, which very much is a character I enjoy playing. But I also don't feel, I'm curious how introspective I should get on this show. It's not like anyone's going to listen to it. So I guess basically it's free rolling from there how deep into the artistic tunnel I can bring you guys into, or instead hope that I can communicate it in a way that is implicative enough of the message that I can maintain the facade that I do on my albums, in my stand-up, in my character, and in my writing. Because, again, with the millennial generation, we give them a lot of flack for identity and such, but they're it seems like this is the first generation that is the most inquisitive about identity. Mostly exhibited by, for instance, that was the most oxymoronic thing I could say, that it might just be in fact moronic. That... Not to say that they didn't exist before the postmodern age, but like transgender and the idea of gender itself, how people can be non-binary, how they can identify as different genders and such. While that's a tradition that dates back to native tribes of the Americas before we killed them. The fact that we are conscious now of it and are making more conscious choices instead of obeying the tradition of the gender as they did in the native tribes, even though there was that blend between male and female, or rather man and woman, genderly speaking, not sexually speaking. Well, even sexually speaking nowadays too, because of transsexualism and just transistiality as a whole. That does not sound like the proper term. That sounds like the layman term or the lame man's term. But that's a great example of how this generation, including sexually too, since homosexuality and other sorts of sexuality have evolved into this generation to the extent where God's getting scared. Or at least that's what people are saying. He probably doesn't really care if he's up there. He's probably got bigger things to worry about, like, maybe Jesus found the porn under the bed or something. I don't know. I don't know what goes on up there. I can act as righteous as I want and as pompous as I want down here, but to think I know what's going on up there makes me a special kind of asshole, probably. And that's also the first time I said that word on this show, and for great emphasis, because those words need to have an impact, especially with this generation that uses it so freely. Because there's never been a great understanding of language at any point in history. And that's also why we flock to writers and we flock to people like Shakespeare, because they're able to hone the language so well that it communicates deeper than the words themselves into the soul itself. I'm curious after this show if anyone had listened to my album or follows me on Twitter, which you can follow me on Twitter at Ray Catullo. They see all the stuff I do and then they listen to this show and they go, what this kid is, that he's talking intellectually, but he tweets the date every day. And this is the point of the show now that gives me an excuse to read my tweets. For example, just to show the dichotomy present right now and the contrast. For being called fasting, it makes everything move so slowly. Any funeral is just an opportunity for more tattoos. I've always wanted to pay for access to Twitter. I don't care what your bumper sticker says. To me, they all read "hit me." All of these are examples of dumb things, I think, that I feel the need to share with people purely because they're dumb and they incite a reaction sometimes. And that reaction is always a sign that someone's listening. And it's some way impacting them. Never know how deep it's permeating into them, but you know if they have something to say to it or some kind of sound is exuded from them. They're reacting. Sometimes it's their last breath because you're so awful you kill them, but that hopefully happens seldom. Not for me. I've killed in a bad way. Because you can kill in a good way, and that's called a good set. But I've never had that. But I'm just curious. This podcast is very much, it's probably the essence of my soul, because this is very much my internal monologue that is being broadcasted, that is being chronicled with this. And I guess that's what podcasting serves as. It serves as kind of investigating the background, because you always see what's in the forefront, in the foreground. You see what occupies the foreground because it's in front of it. But what lies behind it? What is it that creates that foreground? Because you can't have a foreground without a background. The background's what makes it a foreground. And there's a lot of things in life that cannot exist without its opposite. That's the idea of contrast. Also why T.S. Eliot is so good. Although I can't say I understand most of the stuff he writes, but I can act like it because it makes me feel things, and that's what matters. I'm also getting to the point in the show where my allergies are acting up because of the fuzz on the microphone and the dust. on the microphone makes my nose itch. But I'm talking. I'm always conflicted how much I should open up about any kind of act, because it's all about the magic of it. Or maybe I'm doing it because I recognize that there is no magic behind my act, so I have nothing to lose at this point. It's probably that one. And after the, wow, we've gone almost the entire 2 hours. My father thought I couldn't do it. He'd be so proud of me. Until he listened to it and then he'd go, what the hell did you talk about? Look, the point I'm trying to make, Dad, is that this is potentially what the new generation of Chronicles could be. Not every week will be about Andy Kaufman. No, it won't be like that. However, it is very much a postmodern, maybe, dare I say, post-neo-postmodern. What's more new than Neo? The Matrix? No. The neo-paleo-postmodern? I don't know. We'll have to go back to the drawing board on that one. We have until whenever I take over the show. Till then, I don't know when the next time I'll do this will be. If there is a next time. Who knows? Who knows? Who knows? I'll tell you whose nose. My nose. It itches a lot. But again, my album. So I decided to record a comedy album. Which itself, that title, I love that title. Because it very much captures everything about that album. For anyone who's wondering. I wrote the album over the course of 2 days. But in all honesty, it was 18 years in the making, because those 2 days were just me writing down routines and jokes that I had written a long time ago, but just laying them out in how I wanted to present them, as well as the ideas. I recorded it over the course of a day. I edited it over a course of 2 days, and it was a total of a 2 week span of making that album. But of course it was 18 years because of the character that you see on that album. It had to come from somewhere. It didn't just transpire or percipate. Percipate? Is that, no, that's not the word. It's not participate. I can't remember the word. Transpire. Just go with transpire. It didn't just transpire out of the air. It had to come from somewhere. It had to come from some kind of experience. Some kind of experience had to form that identity. Not necessarily a free identity, because there is no. Free will itself is a conundrum, because how much is your will free and not influenced by actions of the past? Because those actions of the past will ultimately influence the choices that you're given. So are you necessarily free? These are questions that we asked our panel. They did not show up tonight. Hopefully you showed up tonight. Or at whatever point it is in time as you're listening to this lifelike. In your car, in your studio, with your family. And as you're listening to this with your family going, why the hell? We miss Frank. We miss Frank. Bring Frank back. Bring Frank back. Oh, that's the other thing. And this is interesting. In my life. That's it. In my life. Any person that has met me and then met my father have said, oh, that makes sense. But the other thing is they go, they always say to me, I love your dad. Your dad is so funny. He's so great. And I never know how to take that, because it's like, thanks, I chose the best dad I could when I went to the dad pound. Yeah, you know, there were many dads that could have fit the cut, but this one was prime cut, baby. I didn't have a choice who my dad was. And I don't know, there's always like there's a weird personal feeling that comes with that, where it's like, that's great, but what about me? And that's all that could be the ego talking. That could be the person talking. Because I know I don't necessarily like to be compared to my father. He still is a great influence on me. One of the greatest, besides my Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. And and to be compared to him, it almost feels like people are saying you are him instead of you are you. Especially when people say you are your father. That really irritates me. I do not like that at all. Because it's neglecting who it is that I am. I'm trying to be. If I'm trying to be anything. Or if I'm just destined to be my father. My name is Ray Catola, and my name adorns the title of the show. We're getting ready to close out this 2-hour special, this 2-hour Ray Catola special, the sun taking over the broadcast. The son, who is often compared to his father, because many people don't know how to take what it is he has to offer. If he has to offer anything, we don't know. I don't know. Many times I say I don't have anything to offer, because it's true, I really don't. And I find great humor in that, and I can't think of anything better than towards the end of Man on the Moon, to bring this full circle. Andy Kaufman flies out to the Philippines for a miracle treatment. He's deep in his terminal cancer. And he goes here. He pays a lot of money to go to the Philippines. And he lays on the table. And the doctor washes his hands in this water. And before Andy goes up, you see him kind of like rip open the skin of a person, and you see blood coming out, and you see him rip out this piece of meat, supposedly supposed to be symbolic of the toxin. And then the person walks out. Andy comes in, and he lays on the table, and he looks over, or at least the camera looks over, and the doctor's washing his hands, and then the camera focuses in, and Andy notices that when the doctor is rubbing into the part of him that is sick, which is the part where his lungs are, he sees that there's a prawn in his hands. A shrimp. And that's supposed to be the meat that he's taking out. And Andy, who comes here for this miracle treatment to realize that he's been duped, just starts laughing. He's gonna die. However, before he does, he experiences perhaps one of the greatest practical jokes that we have, which is the futility of hope. And he just sits there and he laughs and laughs and laughs when he realizes he's gonna die. My name is Ray Catola. My name adorns the title of the show. Frank should be back next week. I hope you guys had fun either listening live or lifelike, wherever it is you were. I did. And with that, it's time to cue the theme. Cue the theme. I said cue the theme. There we go. 2 hours. It goes by. Even by yourself. Reminders, this is the time where I can plug things. My album, So I Decided to Record a Comedy Album, available on YouTube as well as at Bandcamp at raycatolo.bandcamp.com. After tonight's episode, if you listen, I highly suggest listening to it, especially because now you have more of an insight into what it is that fueled the kind of madness that you would witness over the half hour of that album. What else? I'm working on a book. I don't know what's going to come out. I hope to have the first draft done by next year. I wish I could say I was touring. I'm not touring. My show North American Horror Update airs Fridays from 9 p.m. Eastern here on SRN1. You can join me, my co-hosts, Mike Pribosi and Rod Alms Jr. We talk gambling and harness racing every week. And me, in character as I am, entertain and also am a great handicapper. You can buy Frank's books. I might as well plug his stuff. You can buy Frank's books over at Amazon.com. Just search Frank Atolo. You got Man of La Mancha. You got Sweet Shepherd. You got a lot of the bookography of Frank. No Tom Savino this week to segue into. However, with all of that, good night, Mrs. Ernschwau, wherever you are. Because I have nothing more to say.